This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Rocket Boys, a memoir by Homer H. Hickam, Jr. Read by Beau Bridges, with an introduction by the author.
Every writer has a story inside him that he knows he must eventually tell. Sometimes it just needs to wait a little, stew in its own juices, until the writer is ready. That story for me was this one, Rocket Boys, a memoir. It was 35 years after we boys launched our last rocket before I wrote a single word about it, or anything that had to do with my life in the little town of Colwood, West Virginia. But when I was ready and started to write, it was as if suddenly I had others there in the room with me, whispering to me, just shushes of conversation, coming as if behind a thick curtain. "Don't forget us," they said. Well, I haven't, and I respectfully dedicate my book to them, my father and my mother, my teachers, the men who were the Rocket Boys, and all the people of Colwood.
Until I began to build and launch rockets, I didn't know my hometown was at war with itself over its children, and that my parents were locked in a kind of bloodless combat over how my brother and I would live our lives. I didn't know that if a girl broke your heart, another girl, virtuous at least in spirit, could mend it on the same night. And I didn't know that the enthalpy decrease in a converging passage could be transformed into jet kinetic energy if a divergent passage was added. The other boys discovered their own truths when we built our rockets, but those were mine. Colwood, West Virginia, where I grew up, was built for the purpose of extracting the millions of tons of rich bituminous coal that lay beneath it. In 1957, when I was 14 years old and first began to build my rockets, there were nearly 2,000 people living in Colwood. My father, Homer Hickam, was the mine superintendent, and our house was situated just a few hundred yards from the mine's entrance, a vertical shaft 800 feet deep. From the window of my bedroom, I could see the black steel tower that sat over the shaft and the comings and goings of the men who worked at the mine. Another shaft, with railroad tracks leading up to it, was used to bring out the coal. The structure for lifting, sorting, and dumping the coal was called the tipple. Every weekday, and even on Saturday when times were good, I could watch the black coal cars rolling beneath the tipple to receive their massive loads, and then smoke-spouting locomotives straining to pull them away. All through the day, the heavy thump of the locomotive's steam pistons thundered down our narrow valleys, the town shaking to the crescendo of grinding steel as the great trains accelerated. Clouds of coal dust rose from the open cars, invading everything, seeping through windows and creeping under doors. Throughout my childhood, when I raised my blanket in the morning, I saw a black, sparkling powder float off of it. My socks were always black with coal dirt when I took my shoes off at night. Our house, like every house in Colwood, was company-owned. The company charged a small monthly rent, automatically deducted from the miner's pay. Some of the houses were tiny and single-storied with only one or two bedrooms. Others were big two-story duplexes built as boarding houses for bachelor miners in the booming 1920s and later sectioned off as individual family dwellings during the Depression. Every 5 years, all the houses in Coalwood were painted a company white, which the blowing coal soon tinged gray. Usually in the spring, each family took it upon themselves to scrub the exterior of their house with hoses and brushes. Our house was on a corner where the state highway turned east toward the mine. A company-paved road went the other way to the center of town. Main Street ran down a valley so narrow in places that a boy with a good arm could throw a rock from one side of it to the other. Every day for the 3 years before I went to high school, I got on my bicycle in the morning with a big white canvas bag strapped over my shoulder and delivered the Bluefield Daily Telegraph down this valley, pedaling past the Coalwood School and the rows of houses that were set along a little creek and up on the sides of the facing mountains. A mile down Main was a large hollow in the mountains, formed where two creeks intersected. Here were the company offices and also the company church, a company hotel called the Clubhouse, the post office building, which also housed the company doctor and the company dentist, and the main company store, which everybody called the big store. On an overlooking hill was the turreted mansion occupied by the company general superintendent, a man sent down by our owners in Ohio to keep an eye on their assets. Main Street continued westward between two mountains, leading to clusters of miners' houses we called Middletown and Frog Level. Two forks led up mountain hollows to the colored camps of Mudhole and Snake Root. There the pavement ended and rutted dirt roads began. The company church was set down on a little grassy knob. In the late 1950s, it came to be presided over by a company employee, Reverend Josiah Lanier, who also happened to be a Methodist. The denomination of the preacher the company hired automatically became ours, too. Before we became Methodists, I remember being a Baptist, and once for a year some kind of Pentecostal. The Pentecostal preacher scared the women, hurling fire and brimstone and warnings of death from his pulpit. When his contract expired, we got Reverend Lanier. I was proud to live in Coalwood. According to the West Virginia history books, no one had ever lived in the valleys and hills of McDowell County before we came to dig out the coal. Up until the early 19th century, Cherokee tribes occasionally hunted in the area, but found the terrain otherwise too rugged and uninviting. Once, when I was 8 years old, I found a stone arrowhead embedded in the stump of an ancient oak tree up on the mountain behind my house. My mother said a deer must have been lucky some long-ago day. I was so inspired by my find, I invented an Indian tribe, the Kolhekans, and convinced the boys I played with, Roy Lee, Odell, Tony, and Sherman, that it had really existed. They joined me in streaking our faces with berry juice and sticking chicken feathers in our hair. For days afterward, our little tribe of savages formed raiding parties and conducted massacres throughout Coalwood. I learned most of what I knew about Coalwood history in my parents' early years at the kitchen table after the supper dishes were cleared. That was when Mom had herself a cup of coffee and Dad had a glass of milk, and if they weren't arguing about one thing or the other, they would talk about the town and the people in it, what was going on at the mine, what had been said at the last woman's club meeting, and sometimes little stories about how things used to be. Brother Jim usually got bored and asked to be excused, but I always stayed, fascinated by their tales. Mr. George L. Carter, the founder of Coalwood, came in on the back of a mule in 1887, finding nothing but wilderness, and after he dug a little, one of the richest seams of bituminous coal in the world. Seeking his fortune, Mr. Carter bought the land from its absentee owners and began construction of a mine. He also built houses, school buildings, churches, a company store, a bakery, and an ice house. He hired a doctor and a dentist, and provided their services to his miners and their families for free. As the years passed and his coal company prospered, Mr. Carter had concrete sidewalks poured, the streets paved, and the town fenced to keep cows from roaming the streets. Mr. Carter wanted his miners to have a decent place to live, but in return he asked for a decent day's work. Coalwood was, after all, a place for work above all else, hard, bruising, filthy, and sometimes deadly work. When Mr. Carter's son came home from World War I, he brought with him his army commander, a Stanford University graduate of great engineering and social brilliance named William Laird, who everyone in town called with the greatest respect and deference, the captain. The captain, a big, expansive man who stood nearly 6.5 feet tall, saw Colwood as a laboratory for his ideas, a place where the company could bring peace, prosperity, and tranquility to its citizens. From the moment Mr. Carter hired him and placed him in charge of operations, the captain began to implement the latest in mining technology. Shafts were sunk for ventilation, and as soon as it was practical, the mules used to haul out the coal from the mine were replaced by electric motors. Later, the captain stopped all the hand digging and brought in giant machines called continuous miners to tear the coal from its seams. The captain expanded Mr. Carter's building program, providing every Colwood miner a house with indoor plumbing, a warm morning stove in the living room, and a coal box the company kept full. For the town's water supply, he tapped into a pristine ancient lake that lay 1,000 feet below. He built parks on both ends of the town and funded the Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, Brownies, Cub Scouts, and the Woman's Club. He stocked the Colwood School Library and built a school playground and a football field. Because the mountains interfered with reception, in 1954 he erected an antenna on a high ridge and provided one of the first cable television systems in the United States as a free service. In 1934, when he was 22 years old, my father applied for work as a common miner with Mr. Carter's company. He came because he had heard that a man could make a good life for himself in Colwood. Almost immediately, the captain saw something in the skinny, hungry lad from Gary, some spark of raw intelligence, perhaps, and took him as a protege. After a couple of years, the captain raised Dad to section foreman, taught him how to lead men and operate and ventilate a mine, and instilled in him a vision of the town. After Dad became a foreman, he wrote Elsie Lavender, a Gary High School classmate who had moved on her own to Florida, to come back to West Virginia and marry him. She refused. Whenever the story was told, Mom took over at this point and said the letter she next received was from the captain, who told her how much Dad loved her and needed her, and would she please stop being so stubborn down there in the palm trees and come to Colwood and marry the boy. She agreed to come to Colwood to visit, and one night at the movies in Welch, when Dad asked her to marry him again, she said if he had a brown mule chewing tobacco wrapper in his pocket, she'd do it. He had one, and she said yes. It was a decision that I believe she often regretted, but still would not have changed. Because he was so dedicated to the captain and the company, I saw little of my father while I was growing up. He was always at the mine, or sleeping prior to going to the mine, or resting after getting back. When I was 7 years old, he came down with colon cancer, passing out in the mine from internal bleeding. The doctors removed a long piece of his intestines, and he went back to work within a month. Colwood was surrounded by forests and mountains dotted with caves and cliffs and gas wells and fire towers and abandoned mines just waiting to be discovered and rediscovered by me and the boys and girls I grew up with. When I wasn't outside playing, I spent hours happily reading. I loved to read, probably the result of the unique education I received from the Colwood school teachers known as the Great Six, a corruption of the phrase grades 1 through 6. When I was in the 4th grade, I started going to the junior high school library to check out the Black Stallion series. There I also discovered Jules Verne. I fell in love with his books, filled as they were with not only great adventures, but scientists and engineers who considered the acquisition of knowledge to be the greatest pursuit of mankind. When I finished all the Verne books in the library, I became the first in line for any book that arrived written by modern science fiction writers, such as Heinlein, Asimov, Van Vogt, Clark, and Bradbury. For all the knowledge and pleasure they gave me, the books I read in childhood did not allow me to see myself past Colwood. Almost all the grown-up Colwood boys I knew had either joined the military services or gone to work in the mine. I had no idea what the future held in store for me. The only thing I knew for sure was my mother did not see me going into the mine. In the morning, before she began her ritual battle against the dust, my mother could nearly always be found with a cup of coffee at the kitchen table in front of an unfinished mural of a seashore. She had been working on the painting ever since Dad took over the mine and we moved into the captain's house. By the fall of 1957, she had painted in the sand and shells and much of the sky and a couple of seagulls. There was an indication of a palm tree going up, too. It was as if she was painting herself another reality. From her seat at the table, she could reflect on her roses and bird feeders through the picture window the company carpenters had installed for her. Per her specifications, it was angled so not a hint of the mine could be seen. Sputnik. In the fall of 1957, after 9 years of classes in the Colwood School, I went across the mountains to Big Creek, the district high school, for the 10th through the 12th grade. Except for having to get up to catch the school bus at 6:30 in the morning, I liked high school right off. There were kids there from all the little towns in the district, and I started making lots of new friends, although my core group remained my buddies from Colwood, Roy Lee, Sherman, and Odell. I guess it's fair to say there were two distinct phases to my life in West Virginia. Everything that happened before October 5, 1957, and everything that happened afterward. My mother woke me early that morning, a Saturday, and said I had better get downstairs and listen to the radio. I threw on my clothes and went downstairs to the kitchen where hot chocolate and buttered toast waited for me on the counter. There was only one radio station we could pick up in the morning, WELC in Welch. Usually the only thing WELC played that early was one record dedication after the other for us high school kids. Jim, a year ahead of me and a football star, usually got several dedications every day from admiring girls. But instead of rock and roll, what I heard on the radio was a steady beep, beep, beep sound. Then the announcer said the tone was coming from something called Sputnik. It was Russian, and it was in space. Mom looked from the radio to me. "What is this thing, Sonny?" I knew exactly what it was. All the science fiction books and Dad's magazines I'd read over the years put me in good stead to answer. "It's a space satellite. We were supposed to launch one this year, too. I can't believe the Russians beat us to it." All day Saturday, the radio announcements continued about the Russian Sputnik. It seemed like each time there was news, the announcer was more excited and worried about it. There was some talk as to whether there were cameras on board, looking down at the United States, and I heard one newscaster wonder out loud if maybe an atomic bomb might be aboard. Dad was working at the mine all day, so I didn't get to hear his opinion on what was happening. At church on Sunday, Reverend Lanier had nothing to say about the Russians or Sputnik during his sermon. Talk on the church steps afterwards was mostly about the football team and its undefeated season. It was taking a while for Sputnik to sink in, at least in Colwood. On the first school day after Sputnik, I threw on one of Jim's hand-me-down cotton jackets, grabbed my books off the banister, and snatched the brown bag lunch Mom held out for me at the front door. I had to run for it. The big yellow bus was already at the stop in front of the Todd's house, and Jack Martin, the driver, waited for no one. He watched sourly, an unlit cigar clamped between his teeth, as I scrambled aboard an inch ahead of the closing doors. "Any later, you be walking, sonny boy." I found a 2-inch sliver of a seat on a bench and squeezed in beside Linda DeHaven and Margie Jones, girls who'd been in my class since the first grade. They shifted minutely and fell back asleep. Jack changed gears, and we were off. My friend and fellow former Colhegan Odell was snoozing up front just behind Jack. Odell was small and excitable. His hair was the pale, nearly translucent color of spun silk. In the seat behind him, Sherman, a compact, muscular kid with a wide, intelligent face, was also sleeping. Sherman's left leg was shriveled and weak, the result of polio. During all our years growing up together, he never complained about his affliction, and I never gave it any mind. He either kept up with the rest of us or he didn't. Roy Lee, thin and long-legged, got on the bus at the next stop, easing down the aisle until he squeezed in behind me. For as long as I could remember, Roy Lee and I had been friends. He'd show up at my house or I'd go up to his, and we'd be off to the mountains playing cowboys or spacemen or pirates or whatever we could think up. Roy Lee was unique among us. He had his own car, the result of an insurance settlement after his father had died in the mine. His mother, wanting to keep Roy Lee in Colwood, had campaigned to keep her company house. Surprisingly, she and Roy Lee had been allowed to stay. Maybe it was because Roy Lee's brother still worked in the mine. Roy Lee was a good-looking kid, and he knew it. His hair was coal black, and he kept it swept back and greased and teased into what we called a D.A., duck's ass. He looked a bit like a very young Elvis. Roy Lee thought he was pretty much girl bait, and I guess he was, seeing as how he had a date nearly every weekend. Owning a car probably helped, too. I was grateful to have Roy Lee, Sherman, and Odell as friends. When I entered the first grade, I found myself in a community of boys from all over the town, and it became apparent that as my father's son, I was marked by his position. Around the kitchen tables at night, Union fathers often identified Homer Hickam as the enemy, and the boys from those families sometimes went out looking for revenge. Jim was always big for his age and known for his terrible temper. I was a much easier target, caught at recess behind the school or loitering around the big store. Though I came home bloody, I never told my mother who attacked me, and my father never knew of it at all. Such was the very real anger of those boys. I felt perhaps they had good reason for wanting to fight me. I did the best I could for a small, nearsighted kid, and each year got to be a little tougher nut to crack. I even managed to bloody a few noses myself. For some reason, Roy Lee, Sherman, and Odell never seemed to mind who my dad was. As far as they were concerned, we were all just Coalwood kids together. The road out of town led past the coal mine, and Jack blew the bus horn at the tipple. Those of us still awake waved at the men at the man hoist, and then we kept going for about a mile until we stopped for the few students that came out of the hollow at 6, named after the 6 ventilation shafts sunk for the mine. There were some houses built up around it. They were the last students to pick up. Then we started up the first of the mountains. Between Coalwood and War, where Big Creek High School was, were 8 miles of twisting, potholed roads. Unless it was snowing, it took Jack about 45 minutes to cover the distance. War had seen better days. Its main street consisted of some tired old stores, a bank, a couple of gas stations, and a crumbling hotel. During the 1920s, according to the history of War kids recounted from their parents, War was a wild, bawdy place of dance halls and gambling houses. Maybe that was why whenever a lady wore too much perfume, my mother would say she smelled like Sunday morning in War. Big Creek High School sat on the outskirts of War, beside the river that gave the district its name. It was a grimy, 3-story brick building with a carefully tended football field in front. On the other side of the football field was a train track. Our classes were often interrupted by the rumble of coal cars and the moans of steam locomotives going past. Sometimes it seemed like they would never stop, train after endless train bound for the world that lay beyond us. After getting to Big Creek, we usually had an hour to wait before classes, and Roy Lee, Sherman, Odell, and I spent the time together in the auditorium, trading homework and watching the girls parade up and down the aisle. That morning, I wanted to sit down with them and talk about algebra. I hadn't figured out the assigned problems to my satisfaction. But nobody else wanted to talk about algebra, not with Sputnik to chew over. Roy Lee was skeptical. "The Russians aren't smart enough to build a rocket. They must have stole it from us." I didn't agree with him and said so. The Russians had built atomic and hydrogen bombs, and they had jet bombers that could reach the United States. So why couldn't they build something like Sputnik, too? Sputnik came up as a topic again later in the day during Mr. Mams's biology class. At the time, I was contemplating a long pickled worm stretched out in a square steel pan. To my everlasting delight, I had somehow managed to get Dorothy Plunk as my partner for the worm dissection. It was my opinion that Dorothy Plunk, a native of War, was the most beautiful girl at Big Creek High. She had a long, shimmering ponytail and eyes the electric blue of my father's 1957 Buick. She also had a budding figure that made me feel like I was going to explode. I had shyly managed to say hello to her in the hall a few times, but hadn't figured out any way to hold a real conversation with her. I couldn't even figure out what to say to her over the dead worm we were supposed to cut up together. The crackle of the intercom system intervened before I could come up with anything. The voice we heard was that of our school principal, Mr. R.L. Turner.
"As I'm sure you know by now, the Russians have launched a satellite into space. There have been many calls for the United States to do something in response. The Big Creek Student Council today has responded to, and I quote, the threat of Sputnik by passing a resolution. I have it in my hand now. That dedicates the remainder of the school year to academic excellence. I approve the council's resolution. That is all."
Dorothy and I had been staring at the intercom. When we looked down, we were facing each other and our eyes were locked. My heart did a little flip-flop when she spoke.
"Are you scared?"
I gulped, trying to breathe. "Of the Russians?" The truth was, at the moment, Dorothy scared me a lot more than a billion Russians. She gave me a soft little smile, and my heart wobbled off its axis. I could smell her perfume even over the formaldehyde.
"No, silly. Cutting open our worm."
Our worm? If it was our worm, couldn't it also be our hearts, our hands, our lips? Not me. I assured her and raised my scalpel, waiting for Mr. Mams to give us the go-ahead. When he did, I made a long cut down the length of the specimen. Dorothy took one look, grabbed her mouth, and lurched out the door, her ponytail flying. Roy Lee chortled from the desk behind me.
"What'd you do, Sonny? Ask her for a date?"
I had never asked any girl out, much less the exalted Dorothy Plunk. I turned to Roy Lee and whispered,
"Do you think she'd go out with me?"
Roy Lee wiggled his eyebrows, a leer on his face.
"I got a car, and it's got a back seat. I'm your driver any time you want."
Emily Sue Buckberry, who was Dorothy's best friend, stared at me, doubt written all over her round face.
"She got a boyfriend, Sonny. A couple of them. One's in college."
Roy Lee countered,
"Oh, they're no competition. You don't know Sonny when he gets going. He's all action in the back seat."
My face flushed at Roy Lee's bragging. I'd never actually been with a girl in a back seat or anywhere else. The best I'd ever done was a kiss on a girl's front porch after a dance, and that was only with Teresa Anello in junior high school just once. I turned back to the worm and made another cut and began to pin back the worm's flesh, taking meticulous notes. I thought to myself, Roy Lee just doesn't understand. Dorothy Plunk was no mere girl. She was to be worshipped, not handled. Happy in my daydream, I cut and wrote, wrote and cut. I was inspired. I was doing the work for Dorothy, my partner on this worm, and maybe more. Over the remains of a giant formaldehyde-soaked worm, I made up my mind to win her. The Big Store Steps was a favorite place for off-shift miners to lounge about, chew tobacco, and gossip. When a topic, especially one that happened outside Colwood, and also didn't involve mining or football, reached the steps, you knew it was important. Sputnik made it by midweek after its launch. I was going inside the store to buy a bottle of pop when I heard one of the miners on the steps.
"We ought to just shoot that damn Sputniker down."
There was a pause while the men all thoughtfully spat tobacco juice in their paper cups, and then another miner spoke up.
"Well, I'll tell you who we ought to shoot. Makes me madder than fire. Them damn people up in Charleston who's trying to cheat Big Creek out of the state champs. I'd like to warp them upside the head."
This got even a louder affirmation from the assembly, followed by some truly hearty spitting. Only coal mining was more important in Colwood than high school football. Sputnik, and anything else, was going to always come in a distant third. What made the miner madder than fire was that Big Creek was on its way to an undefeated season, but according to the West Virginia High School Football Association, it was ineligible for the state championship because it played too many Virginia schools. On the man-trip cars into the mine, at the company stores, and even in church, this was a topic of endless discussion and debate. Big Creek kept winning, and the people in charge of high school football up in Charleston kept saying it didn't matter. There was no way we were going to be state champs. It didn't take much of a genius to see there was some kind of trouble ahead. As it turned out, it was my dad who ended up causing the trouble. Brother Jim was a fury on the football field. He played tackle on offense and linebacker on defense, and opposing quarterbacks ran from him like scared rabbits. He could hit like a locomotive and was a devastating blocker. At the time, a player as good as Jim was accorded nearly the same celebrity status across Big Creek District as Johnny Unitas and Bart Starr in the outside world. My father, utterly thrilled by Jim's gridiron prowess, was elected as president of the Big Creek Football Fathers Association. I was watching television in the living room one night when Mom suggested to Dad, after he had spent some minutes on the mine phone, which we called the black phone, boasting about Jim to one of his foremen, that it might be a good thing if he bragged on me every once in a while. Even though he knew I was in the same room, Dad thought for a moment and then wondered aloud, quite honestly, "What about?" I'm sure I didn't know either. I had no proclivity for football whatsoever. For one thing, I was terribly nearsighted. When I went to Big Creek, Coach Merrill Gaynor, the winningest coach in Southern West Virginia history, took one look at me, lost inside the practice gear, and ordered me off his football field. I joined Big Creek's marching band as a drummer. Mom said she'd like my uniform. Dad had no comment. Jim was mortified and called me a moron, chicken, and a sister. Jim's words had stung, but I shut up. I couldn't understand what all the interest in football was anyway, and especially why the football boys were considered heroes. They were out on a field with a referee who made sure everybody followed all the rules, and the players wore pads on their shoulders and hips and thighs and knees and helmets on their heads. What was heroic about lining up and following the rules and wearing a bunch of stuff that was going to keep you from getting hurt? I just never could understand it. Dad remained silent at the table, but I noticed he and Jim exchanged a look of what I took to be agreement about the shame of me being in the band. I looked over at Mom for support, but she was looking through the window behind me. I suppose there were birds at her feeder. I thought to myself, I like the uniform, and I like playing the snare drum. And Dorothy Plunk's in the band, too. That last thought made me give Jim a smug look that confused him no end. All that fall, the Welch Daily News and the Bluefield Daily Telegraph were filled with stories of our American scientists and engineers at Cape Canaveral in Florida, desperately working to catch up with the Russians. It was as if the science fiction I had read all my life was coming true. I read every article I could find about the men at the Cape and kept myself pinned to the television set for the latest on what they were doing. I began to hear about one particular rocket scientist named Dr. Wernher von Braun. His very name was exotic and exciting. I saw on television where Dr. von Braun had given an interview, and he said in a crisp German accent that if he got the go-ahead, he could put a satellite into orbit within 30 days. The newspapers said he'd have to wait, that the program called Vanguard would get the first chance. At night, before I went to sleep, I thought about what Dr. von Braun might be doing at that very moment down at the Cape. I could just imagine him high on a gantry, lying on his back like Michelangelo, working with a wrench on the fuel lines of one of his rockets. I started to think about what an adventure it would be to work for him, helping him to build rockets and launching them into space. For all I knew, a man with that much conviction might even form an expedition into space, like Lewis and Clark. Either way, I wanted to be with him. I knew to do that I'd have to prepare myself in some way, get some skills of some kind or special knowledge about something. I was kind of vague on what it would be, but I could at least see I would need to be like the heroes in my books, brave, and knowing more than the next man. I was starting to see myself past Colwood. Wernher von Braun, Dorothy Plunk. My song now had two names in it. When the papers printed that Sputnik was going to fly over southern West Virginia, I decided I had to see it for myself. I told my mother, and pretty soon the word spread, fence to fence, that I was going to look at Sputnik, and anybody else who wanted to could join me in my backyard the evening it was scheduled to appear. It didn't take much in Colwood to create a gathering. On the appointed night, Mom joined me in the backyard, and then other women arrived and a few small children. Roy Lee, Sherman, and Odell were there, too. The ladies clustered around Mom, and she held court. Since Dad was who he was, she could always be counted on to know the latest on what the company was planning and which foreman was up and which was down. It got darker, and the stars winked on one by one. I sat on the back steps, turning every few seconds to check the clock on the kitchen wall. I was afraid maybe Sputnik wouldn't show up, and even if it did, we'd miss it. The mountains that surrounded us only allowed a narrow sliver of sky to view. I had no idea how fast Sputnik would be, whether it would zip along or dawdle. I figured we'd have to be lucky to see it. Roy Lee came and sat down beside me. Jim wandered outside and contemplated Roy Lee and me. He was eating a moon pie. "Idiots," he concluded. "Tenth grade morons." Jim always had such a way with words. He squashed the entire pie in his mouth and chewed it contentedly. One of the neighbor girls down the street saw him and came over and stood as close to him as she dared. He smirked and rubbed his hand along the small of her back while she shivered in nervous delight. Roy Lee stared in abject admiration. "I don't care if they break every bone in my body. I got to go out for football next year." Suddenly, Odell was jumping up and down and pointing skyward. "Look, look, Sputnik!" Roy Lee sprang to his feet and yelled, "I see it too!" Then Sherman whooped and pointed. I stumbled off the steps and squinted in the general direction everybody was looking. All I could see were millions of stars. Mom took my head and sighted my nose at a point in the sky. "There!" Then I saw the bright little ball moving majestically across the narrow star field between the ridgelines. I stared at it with no less rapt attention than if it had been God himself in a golden chariot riding overhead. It soared with what seemed to me inexorable and dangerous purpose, as if there was no power in the universe that could stop it. I felt that if I stretched out enough, I could touch it. Then, in less than a minute, it was gone. "Pretty thing," Mom said, summing up the general reaction of the backyard crowd. She and the other ladies went back to talking. It was a good hour before everybody else wandered off, but I remained behind, my face turned upward. I kept closing my mouth, and it kept falling open again. I had never seen anything so marvelous in my life. I was still in the backyard when Dad came home. He opened the gate and saw me. "Aren't you out late?" I didn't reply. I didn't want to break the spell Sputnik had cast over me. Dad looked up at the sky with me. "Are you still looking for Sputnik?" "Saw it," I said finally. Dad looked up with me for a little longer, but when I didn't elaborate, he shook his head and went down into the basement. I soon heard the shower running and the sound of him scrubbing with brushes and lava soap. He'd already showered at the mine, most likely, but Mom wouldn't let him in the house if he had a molecule of coal anywhere on him. On November 3rd, the Russians struck again, launching Sputnik 2. This one had a dog in it. Laika was her name. And by her picture in the paper, she looked a little like my dog, Poteet. I went out into the yard and called Poteet over and picked her up. She wasn't a big dog, but she felt pretty heavy. Mom saw me and came outside. "What are you doing to that dog?" "I was just wondering how big a rocket it would take to put her into orbit. If she don't stop peeing on my rose bushes, she's going into orbit. Won't need any rocket." My dad got two magazines in the mail every week, Newsweek and Life. When they came, he read them from cover to cover, and then I got them next. In a November issue of Life, I found, to my great interest, drawings of the internal mechanisms of a variety of different kinds of rockets. I studied them carefully, and then I remembered reading how Wernher von Braun had built rockets when he was a youngster. An inspiration came to me. At the supper table that night, I put down my fork and announced that I was going to build a rocket. Dad, musing into his glass of cornbread and milk, said nothing. He was probably working through some ventilation problem, and I doubt if he even heard me. Jim snickered. He probably thought it was a sister thing to do. Mom stared at me for a long while and then said, "Well, don't blow yourself up." I gathered Roy Lee, Odell, and Sherman in my room. "We're going to build a rocket." The other boys looked at one another and shrugged. Roy Lee said, "Where will we launch it?" "The fence by the rose bushes." My house was narrowly fitted between two mountains and a creek, but there was a small clearing behind Mom's rose garden. Odell looked thoughtful. "But what will we make our rocket out of? I can get stuff if you tell me what we need." Odell's father, Red, was the town garbage man. On weekends, Odell and his brothers helped out on the truck and saw just about every kind of stuff there was in Coalwood one time or another. Sherman was always a practical boy with an orderly mind. "Do we know how to build a rocket?" I showed them the Life magazine. "All you have to do is put fuel in a tube and a hole at the bottom of it." "What kind of fuel?" I had already given the matter some thought. "I've got 12 cherry bombs left over from the 4th of July. I've been saving them for New Year's. We'll use the powder out of them." We all sat around in a little circle and looked at one another. I didn't have to spell it out. It was an important moment, and we knew it. We boys in Coalwood were joining the space race. Roy Lee nodded. "All right, let's do it." I appointed myself chief rocket designer. Odell provided me a small discarded plastic flashlight to use as the body of the rocket. I emptied its batteries and then punched a hole in its base with a nail. I cracked open my cherry bombs and poured the powder from them into the flashlight and then wrapped it all up in electrical tape. I took one of the cherry bomb fuses left over and stuck it in the hole and then glued the entire apparatus inside the fuselage of a D-winged plastic model airplane. I recall it was an F-100 Super Sabre. Since Sherman couldn't run very fast, and also because it was his idea, he was placed in charge of the countdown, a position that allowed him to stand back. Roy Lee was to bring the matches. Odell was to strike the match and hand it to me. I would light the fuse and make a run for it. Everybody had something to do. When night came, we balanced our rocket, looking wicked and sleek, on top of my mother's rose garden fence. The fence was a source of some pride and satisfaction to her. It had taken 6 months of her reminding Dad before he finally sent Mr. McDuff down from the mine to build it. The night was cold and clear, all the better, we thought, for us to track our rocket as it streaked across the dark, starry sky. We waited until some coal cars rumbled past, and then I lit the fuse and ran back to the grass at the edge of the rose bushes. Odell smacked his hand over his mouth to smother his excited giggle. Sparkles of fire dribbled out of the fuse. Sherman was counting backward from 10. We waited expectantly, and then Sherman reached 0 and yelled, "Blast off!" just as the cherry bomb powder detonated. There was an eyewitness, a miner waiting for a ride at the gas station across the street. For the edification of the fence gossipers, he would later describe what he had seen. There was, he reported, a huge flash in the Hickams yard and a sound like God himself had clapped his hands. Then an arc of fire lifted up and up into the darkness, turning and cartwheeling and spewing bright sparks. The way the man told it, our rocket was a beautiful and glorious sight, and I guess he was right, as far as it went. The only problem was, it wasn't our rocket that streaked into that dark, cold, clear, and starry night. It was my mother's rose garden fence. Wooden splinters whistled past my ears. Big chunks of the fence arced into the sky. Burning debris fell with a clatter. A thunderous echo rumbled back from the surrounding hollows. Dogs up and down the valley barked, and house lights came on one by one. People came out and huddled on their front porches. Later I would hear that a lot of them were wondering if the mine had blown up or maybe the Russians had attacked. At that moment, I wasn't thinking about anything except a big orange circle that seemed to be hovering in front of my eyes. When I regained some sensibility and my vision started to come back, the circle diminished and I started to look around. All the other boys were sitting in the grass holding their ears. With relief, I noted that it didn't look like any of them had suffered any serious damage. The dogs had retreated to the farthest corner of the yard. They were crawling on their bellies back toward us when Mom came out on the back porch and peered into the darkness. "Sonny?" she called. Then I think she saw the burning fence.
"Oh, my good Lord!"
Dad, holding his newspaper, came out beside her.
"What happened, Elsie?"
At my father's appearance, the other boys suddenly jumped up and ran off. I heard my mom's voice again.
"Sonny Hickam, you get over here!"
Rubbing my ears in an attempt to stop them from ringing, I lurched over to the back porch and waited expectantly for one of my parents to come down off it and kill me. Dad went back inside, shaking his head. Mom walked over and stood beside me. She looked at the smoldering ruin of her fence and sighed deeply. I braced myself. but her voice was soft.
"Didn't I tell you not to blow yourself up?"
Then she pointed at the back porch and said,
"Go sit on the steps. We need to talk, you and me."
I did as I was told with the enthusiasm of a prisoner going to his own beheading. Mom stood before me and crossed her arms and stuck her chin out.
"Sonny, do you think you could build a real rocket?"
She so startled me by her question that I forgot my usual coyness.
"No, ma'am, I don't know how."
She rolled her eyes.
"I know you don't know how. I'm asking you, if you put your mind to it, could you do it?"
I searched for her trap to make me do something I didn't want to do. I was sure it was there. It was just a matter of finding it. I thought I'd better say something.
"Well, I guess I could."
Mom stopped me. She knew I was just going to ramble.
"Oh, Sonny, you're a sweet kid. I love you. But doggone it, you've just been drifting along like you were on a cloud your whole life, making up games and leading Roy Lee and Sherman and Odell off on all your wild schemes. I'm thinking maybe it's time you straighten up a bit."
I started to squirm.
"I was worrying about you the other night to your dad. I was just kind of wondering out loud what you were going to do with yourself when you grew up. He said for me not to worry. He'd find you a job on the outside up at the mine. You know what that means, Sonny? You'd be some kind of clerk working for your dad, sitting at a typewriter pecking out forms, or writing in a ledger about how many tons got loaded in a day. That's the best your dad thinks you can do." A question just seemed to jump out of my mouth. It even surprised me. I guess I'd been wondering about it for a long time and didn't know it. "Why doesn't Dad like me?" Mom looked like I'd slapped her in the face. She was quiet for a moment, obviously chewing over my question.
"It's not that he doesn't like you. It's just with the mine and all, he's never had much time to think about you one way or the other."
If that was supposed to make me feel any better, it didn't work. I knew Dad thought about Jim all the time, was always telling people what a great football player my brother was and how he was going to tear up the world in football when he went to college. Mom sat down beside me and put her arm around my shoulders. I twitched at her unfamiliar touch. It had been a long time since she hugged me. We just didn't do much of that kind of thing in our family. Again, her voice was soft.
"You've got to get out of Coalwood, Sonny. Jimmy will go. Football will get him out. I'd like to see him a doctor or a dentist, something like that. But football will get him out of Coalwood, and then he can go and be anything he wants to be."
She clutched my shoulder, pulling me hard against her side. For a little bit, I would have put my head on her shoulder, but I sensed that would be going too far.
"It's not going to be easy for you. You and me, we've got to figure out some way to make your dad change his mind about you, see his way clear to send you to college. I've been saving money right along, and probably have enough for you to go, but your dad would have a hissy right now if I said that's what I was going to do. Say it's a waste of good money. He's got it in his head you're going to stay around here, have some little job at his mine."
She dropped her arm off my shoulder. I felt suddenly chilled without it.
"Coalwood's going to die, deader than a hammer."
She had lost me with that one.
"Ma'am?"
She stood up. I saw that her eyes were glistening. "You can't count on the mine being here when you graduate from high school, Sonny. You can't even count on this town being here. Pay attention, will you? Look at the kids at Big Creek from Berwind, Bartley, Cucumber. Their fathers are out of work, and those towns are just falling down around them. It's the economy, and it's the easy coal playing out, and it's... I don't know what all it is, but I've got sense enough to know it's just a matter of time before the same thing happens here in Coalwood, too. You need to do everything you can to get out of here, starting right now." I didn't know what to say. I just stared at her. She sighed again. "To get out of here, you've got to show your dad you're smarter than he thinks. I believe you can build a rocket. He doesn't. I want you to show him I'm right and he's wrong. Is that too much to ask?" Before I could reply, she stomped past me and went inside.
I tried to think, to catch up with all she had said. When I went inside, Dad was still on the black phone. He said nearly everything over the company phone in exclamations.
Get number four back online, and I mean now.
Number four was undoubtedly one of the huge ventilators on the surface that forced air through the mine. Whoever was on the other end apparently wasn't giving him the response he wanted.
I'm leaving the house right now, and it better be going by the time I get there.
He slammed the receiver down. I watched him throw open the hall closet and snatch his jacket and hat. He rushed past me without a glance, just as if I didn't exist, and went out the back door. I heard the gate unlatch and close, and he was gone into the night. It was past midnight when Dad returned. I had just dozed off after a round of thinking about all that Mom had said. I heard him creep up the stairs, and then I started thinking all over again. I got up and opened my window. The tipple loomed before me like a giant black spider. A big golden moon hovered overhead, and the vapor formed a misty circle around it. Sparkling stars flowed down the narrow river of sky the mountains allowed. I looked at the tiny pricks of light so far away. I didn't know one star from the other, didn't know much of anything about the reality of space. I knew less than nothing about rockets, too. I suddenly felt as stupid as Dad apparently thought I was. Mom had said for me to build a rocket, show him what I could do. I had already been thinking about learning enough to go to work for Wernher von Braun. Her Elsie Hickam scholarship, if approved by Dad, would fit right in with that. Then I remembered what Mom had said about Colwood dying. That was the hardest thing to understand of all the things she had told me. All around me, Colwood was always busily playing its industrial symphony of rumbling coal cars, spouting locomotives, the tromping of the miners going to and from the mine. How could that ever end? The final regular season football game ended with Big Creek winning big over Tazewell High School just across the Virginia border. Jim sent two quarterbacks to the sidelines on stretchers and intercepted a pass and ran it back for a touchdown. With that victory, the team had won all its games. Then the State High School Athletic Association did exactly what they said they were going to do and ruled Coach Gaynor's boys were not eligible to play in the state championship game. Although it was no surprise, there was still an instant uproar all over the district. The football fathers were besieged with demands from fans and the football team to do something. Jim asked Dad every night at supper for a week after the last game what he was going to do. Dad kept saying he was looking into it. Finally, one night at supper, he said he was going to go see a lawyer in Welch. Mom put down her fork and stared at Dad in disbelief. Homer, I don't think that's wise. Dad shoveled in a spoonful of beans and cornbread. Elsie, I know what I'm doing. He didn't look at her. Mom settled into a deep frown. No, you don't. The Charleston muckety-mucks don't want us to play, and they're not going to let us play. No lawyer's going to change that. You're just asking for trouble. Just let it go, Homer. Dad rolled his head on his neck. I could hear it creak. Ducking his head in the mine all day probably didn't do it a lot of good. We've made up our minds, Elsie. The football fathers are going to Welch. Mom knew the Bible pretty much by heart, and she was quite capable of using it on Dad like a club. And if the blind leadeth the blind, both shall fall into the ditch, she told him, making her argument unassailable because it was clearly on the side of the Lord. After an evident moment of confusion, Dad replied, Thank you for your vote of confidence, Reverend Lavender. Then the black phone rang, ever the convenient way to end discussion in our house. Dad yelled at whomever was on the other end, and then headed out the door, throwing on his coat and hat as he went. I had no doubt he was grateful for the interruption. He didn't come home until past midnight. Sometimes when he did that, I wondered if he wasn't just sitting around his office checking his watch until Mom went to bed. A week later, as Mom had feared, the football fathers had themselves a proud little suit. The championship game was only a week away, so it was necessary to press the court to act fast.
3 days after it was filed, a state judge in Bluefield took one look at the case and threw it out of court on a technicality. The championship game was held as scheduled in Charleston, and the season was officially over. Jim was so mad he locked himself in his room all day, except to come downstairs to eat and watch television and talk to some girls on the home telephone. I kept out of his way, retreating to a chair in the living room to read Dad's latest Newsweek. Then Dad made things even worse. "We're going to appeal. We're going to go over that judge's head." Mom was aghast.
"But the game's been played."
"It's the principle of the thing." Mom went into the living room and stood over him.
"What principle? It's high school football."
Dad turned the page as if he had just finished an article. I noticed from my position that he had turned to the comic page, which he never read. When Mom kept looking at him, he finally said, his eyes still firmly planted on the funnies, "This is man's work, Elsie."
"Maybe so, Homer, but this woman is telling you it's going to lead to disaster."
In December 1957, the United States made its first attempt to put a satellite into orbit with its Vanguard. I saw the result the next day on television. Vanguard managed 3 tentative feet off the pad, lost thrust, and then blew up. According to the papers, the whole country was shocked and disappointed. I was, too. I read some newspaper editorials and television commentary that wondered if perhaps Western civilization itself might soon be at an end, with the technologically superior Russians taking over. I might have worried even more about Vanguard's failure if I hadn't had rocket problems of my own. Vanguard, after all, had managed to fly a yard higher than I had. There was a lot of smart people working on that project, and I guessed they'd figure things out sooner or later. I, on the other hand, was all alone. That's why I decided, like it or not, I had to talk to Quentin. Quentin was the class joke. He used a lot of big words, often delivered in a pseudo-English accent, and he carried around an old cracked leather briefcase, stuffed to overflowing with books and who knew what else. While the rest of us played dodgeball or did calisthenics and phys ed, he always had some excuse not to participate, a sprained ankle or a headache or some such, and sat in the bleachers and read one of his books. While all the other students traded gossip and nonsense in the auditorium in the morning and at lunch, Quentin always sat alone. He had no friends, as far as I could tell. Although everybody, including me, made fun of him, I was pretty certain he was some sort of a genius. He could expound on nearly any subject in class until the teacher had to ask him to stop, and if he'd ever made less than 100 on a test, I wasn't aware of it. I figured if there was anybody who might know how to build a rocket, it was Quentin. The next morning before classes, I sat down beside him in the auditorium. Startled, he pulled his book down from his face and regarded me suspiciously.
"I don't let anybody copy my homework."
"I don't want to copy your homework. Do you know anything about rockets?" A little smile crossed his face. Quentin wasn't a bad-looking kid for a genius. He had a narrow face, a sharp nose, crisp blue eyes, and jet-black hair that looked like it had been plastered down with about a quart of wild root cream oil.
"I wondered how long it would take for you to come to me with that question. I heard about your rocket, old boy. Blew up, didn't it? What made you think you could build a rocket? You can't even do algebra."
"I'm getting better," I muttered. It was amazing to me that everybody, even Quentin, knew my business.
"One of my little sisters can already do algebra. I taught her. It's really quite simple."
In less than a minute, he'd already pretty much irritated me. "So what do you know about rockets? Anything?"
"I know everything."
He said it too easily.
"Let's hear it, then."
He raised one of his bony shoulders in a shrug.
"What's in it for me?"
"What do you want?"
"To help you build the next one."
That was a surprise. Now I was suspicious. "If you know so much, why don't you build your own?" Quentin built a little church with his hands.
"I've considered building a rocket for some time, if you must know. Practical reasons, unfortunately, have prevented me from taking action. It takes teamwork to build a rocket and materials. My observation of you is that you have certain leadership abilities that I do not."
He locked his eyes on me. They were intense, almost like they were capable of shooting rays.
The other boys will follow you, and you, being the superintendent's son at Colwood, can probably get all the materials you need.
He put out his hand.
How about it?